Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS, and this is the Limelight Technical Net. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. since 1982, it's been going on, archived since September of 2006. As I mentioned, I am Roy, AC2GS, and I, as always, I like to remind people of a couple of email addresses and URLs. If you have any questions for the Technical Net but can't get onto it via Echo link or directly to our repeaters or IRLP, you can email us. You can also do that if you want to suggest any topics or if you have any puzzles that you'd like me to share with the audience or if you'd like me to tap Paul, WS2N, on the shoulder and ask him his opinion of some space-related news that you've seen either in YouTube or websites. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. There will be links available for articles that we might mention, topics that lend themselves to web linked addresses. So please check it out. The link address is just to type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that will send you to my link page. Again, roy.ac2gs.com. As always, we have a chat room available. You can either get to it via Limelight's own website, or you can type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that will take you directly to the chat room. We are streaming this audio. If you don't have Echolink or IRLP, and you just don't have a radio within range of the repeaters, it is streamed on the Internet. You type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and you'll be able to hear my audio stream. And as I always like to mention, MikeKC2NJI has a wonderful archive site of the Technical Net at amateurradio.tv. He has archives going as far back as September 2006. So please avail yourself of it. It's the material is not dated at all. It is incredibly useful, and Dick explaining things is a very nice thing to listen to. Let me drop for a second. Once again, the plan for tonight is I will ask anyone if they have any questions or comments for the Technical Net and ask for their first name and their call sign. And people and put people down on the list according to who check-ins first. Anywhere from about 8:30 to 9 o'clock, we will have the next episode of Andy, WA2CDL's Andy's Corner, where he will be discussing a QST article on the subject of impedance matching. Then I'll come back and take any further questions or comments or discussions and maybe read an article or two out of the science news. And around 10:15, give or take, I will introduce Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report. And that should take us to 11 p.m., which is our usual closing time. So with all that in mind, let the games begin. If anyone has any questions or comments tonight, please give me your call sign and your first name.
KG2RY, David, good evening.
K2GJE, Ed.
David recognized, Ed recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? I mean, we'll take questions even later on, but the first people who sign up are the first people who get to talk. Very well. We will take you, David, KG2RY, first. What is your question or your topic for tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Roy. I was playing around with audio, the audio out of my HF radio. Now, Heil makes a powered speaker and an equalizer that connects to it. So I thought, well, I can't afford to buy Heil equipment, it's very expensive. So I got, let me draw. So I got a powered speaker that I already owned, and I took from a acoustic guitar equalizer, which is a four-band equalizer. I realized, you know, I needed to increase the bass. The bass was suffering. So, you know, I put this thing together and I raised the bass, and it's fantastic. It's perfect. What do you know about this kind of setup?
Well, to me, it's a very common setup. A lot of radios have their own built-in microphone speaker, but it doesn't kind of give you that much oomph. My primary radio, my Flex 6700, does not have a speaker built into it. My ICOM 7100, which I'm working on right now, does, but I output all the audio through my computer, and then the computer's audio uses powered speakers. The only upshot that you have to think about with the powered speakers is make sure that they're well designed in that they're shielded. If they're inexpensive Chinese knockoff powered speakers, very often the shielding is very limited. RF can get very easily into the speaker enclosure and confuse the amplifier built into it, and you'll get all kinds of harmonics and such. So a well-built powered speaker is an excellent thing. I have Audio Engine powered speakers. They're small desk versions, and I have actually a subwoofer off to the side of my shack in case I want to listen to music as well. But that's a very common thing. Heil, I believe, makes a parametric equalizer. For the sake of amateur radio, you don't quite need the same frequency range as you would for normal music or musical instruments. Really, most of the business is handled below 3 kilohertz. You know, sometimes an extended single sideband, it can go up to 4 or 5 kilohertz. Some people like graphic equalizers, some like parametric. As long as it evens out the curve to your listening pleasure, that's all that really counts.
QSL. And I will say, you know, by increasing the bass, the bottom two levers, you know, the controls, the furthest one down a little more than the next one, and, you know, it even makes the... It makes it easier to hear single sideband audio coming from there. How to say that the signals that are almost inaudible become audible. So for some strange way, and I guess, you know, Heil was talking about that in their demonstration of their product, and I guess it caught on for me, and I was able to do it with things that were already in the shack.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the most cost-effective means is repurposing equipment that you already have. Again, most of my audio systems I got for my computer, and I just plug all my radio equipment through my computer and kill two birds with one stone, as it is. As far as equalizers, I have available a graphic equalizer. I haven't used it in a long, long time because I'm able to basically equalize within the computer as well. Especially the Flex 6700 has a kind of built into the software equalizing circuit where you can adjust the settings and have it contoured in the SDR, but you know, a lot of people have mixers, a lot of people have different equalizers. As long as they're relatively low noise and well shielded, that they can be repurposed for these purposes.
QSL, Roy, the ones that I use mainly for guitar, either electric guitar or acoustic guitar, So the frequency bandwidth is much wider, from maybe 20 to 20,000 cycles. So the bandwidth of communications, which is from about 300 to 3,200 cycles, falls within. So you can play around with the controls and get the right result. I also like to listen to AM broadcasts, and it all makes it sound really good. Shortwave AM broadcast.
Yeah, I would agree with you that tweaking the equalization makes it a little bit easier on the ears. There's a lot of computational analysis that sometimes goes on between our ears when the signals are rather noisy and we're actually doing a lot of cognitive functions to kind of integrate the audio signals and get the most information. And it can be rather fatiguing, and no doubt you've experienced times where there was a heavy background noise and a very difficult readability of a signal, where at the end of your conversation you're kind of mentally fatigued because, you know, unbeknownst to us, your brain kind of burns a little bit heavy when it has to make sense of it. So if you can help that a little bit along by tweaking one of the frequency envelopes, you know, it depends upon the circumstances. Sometimes a little treble helps, sometimes a little bass helps. As you mentioned, you know, doing any adjustment above about 3,200, 3,300 cycles is meaningless, because the signal envelope that you're trying to recover, at least on single sideband, is below it. So as long as you keep in mind what frequencies really are involved, you can tweak it. Some people tweak it excessively. I've seen guys on QSL pages, QRZ pages, where they have these racks and racks and racks of sound processing equipment that make it look like it belongs in an FM radio station. But, you know, whatever floats your boat.
QSL, Roy. Yeah, I took mine and I put it into the settings that sounded the best to me. Even before I had it set up, I wanted to add some bass there. It's just something wrong with the signal quality coming through. And I wanted to just add some bass. And then when I put the bass in, it sounded perfectly right for me. And then I don't change it. I just leave it there.
Okay, whatever works for you. Sometimes it's just a function of the amplification circuits, what they have a degree of emphasis, and you might want to tweak and adjust and change that. Sometimes bass can produce a muddy audio. It's much easier, of course, to equalize a receiving signal because you get immediacy. It's much more problematic, as everyone has found in the past, trying to get a good transmission signal. Sometimes if you have multiple antennas and multiple radios, you can listen to your own signal. Other times you may have to either listen to a web SDR reception from a distant station, listen to your signal through that, or worst comes to worst, find a friend with good ears and ask him how you sound and make the adjustments accordingly.
Well, in this case, for the transmit signal, I leave it up to Yaesu. Yaesu, the microphone that came with the radio, and the electronics inside the box. They did such a good job, I don't want to change that.
Okay, very good. You were very lucky. My one question is, are you using the microphone that came with the radio, or are you using a third-party microphone?
Well, you know, Roy, I would always recommend to people to use the microphone that came with the radio. Yeah, this is the original microphone. And it's the same with the Kenwood dual bander, and the same with the 220 radio also. And all the HTs that operate the digital modes.
much. Okay, very good. So, you know, you have less variables. Usually equalization is a function of a lot of things. The electronics of the radio, the make model design of the element of the microphone, and, you know, all the other, and your voice. Different voices usually might tweak in different directions. If you're a high register, other people with a low bassy voice. So it's a complex combination of all the above. So, you know, having a standardized microphone element makes it a little bit simpler that way. I have the microphones for all my radios. I almost never use them. I tend to prefer headsets. Right now I'm using a 2Q Lite headset. It's very comfy, and I don't have to hold on to it, and I don't have to think where my mouth is because it's always behind the microphone element. But, you know, there's a lot of different headsets and microphones available. Some people love to stay with the brand, and that certainly is less expensive because they usually throw it in the box. You know, there are guys out there who love their D104s. They look beautiful. I'm not quite a fan of piezoelectric microphone elements personally, but again, whatever floats your boat.
QSL. I don't have any room for big microphones, but on the HF radio, Fox Tango 891, on the back of the microphone there's a switch, low and high, low and high, and I think that's the equalization. You can just choose. I think you can also change the mic gain in there, the mic gain, and you can compress the audio, some kind of compression circuitry in there.
Well, I mean, that makes sense. It doesn't really require a great deal of electronics, a slide switch, and maybe a capacitor to kind of tweak and adjust the impedance. Usually, compression is very useful for DX single sideband. You don't really need or want to compress your audio for something like FM repeaters, but you get a little bit more punch out of a compressed you know, audio transmission that's then fed into the modulator.
QSL, it's either that or you can just talk loud.
Well, yes, you can talk loud, and you can also raise the microphone gain just below clipping, it depends upon the way that you speak. Some people kind of can reach maximum amplitude most of their waveform. The beauty of a compressor, and the reason why people were very annoyed when they started to use them for commercials, because television commercials had a limitation of the maximum audio output, but no comment about how much you can average and compress it so that everything is the same high signal. It depends upon your voice. Some people have a great voice that's loud and booming. Other people fluctuate all over the place, and when you put a compressor in between, you can squeeze a couple more decibels out.
QSL. Yeah, I heard a lot of that on the air. I know a lot of people that have only 100 watts and a dipole. You know, they want to compress and they want to try to extend their signal. And I try to find loud signals to call, so I don't have to extend my signal any more than it already is.
Well, yeah, I mean, often people will respond to the loudest, most intelligible transmission that they receive. So that's a very, very common approach to it. There are problems with overusing a compressor. There are artifacts that occur as you tweak it up. A lot of radios will have multiple settings. Usually they'll have some notation of either DX or compressor. And if you bump it up too much, you get this weird artifact of breathing where the background noise kind of takes a little bit longer to degrade. So you'll, the guy will stop talking, but the gain will be up, and you'll hear background hiss, and then it will finally figure out that the voice has stopped, and it'll quiet things. And every time he talks, you'll have that pause between him stopping talking and the compressor circuit realizing that, and you get breathing artifacts. So it can be annoying at extremes. With a soft touch, a compressor can be very useful for DXing on single sideband.
QSL, bad audio can be really annoying, and also it could give you a headache. You know, some people that listen to their radios all day, quality of the sound is terrible. Maybe not only from the signals that they're receiving, but the actual receive circuitry speaker configuration, you know. And, you know, I think easy talking is great, you know, and they say you get a front-firing speaker and you have the ease of a conversation.
Well, it sort of depends on what the individual wants. One of the nice things about our hobby is that it's very deep and very wide. It allows for all kinds of different behaviors. Some people like to rag chew. Others like to play tag. Then there are other people who love FT8, which is great if you want to make contact. You don't really build much of a relationship with people as you're pretty much exchanging call signs and RST and other facts and very little about the individuals. And if that's what you like to do, then so be it. But it's always nice to have an intelligent conversation with someone, and having good readability certainly helps a lot.
QSL, I agree with you 100%. For me, it's, you know, not even about the equipment or the building of equipment or the antennas or whatever. For me, it's about the QSO. People can have excellent conversations, but that's what I like. You know, maybe other people like other things.
Well, yeah, David, as I mentioned before, there are guys who love rag chewing and different guys who love rag chewing about different things. That's why there's specialty nets. That's why there's places where people tend to join together. You know, there's a place on 40. It's a lot about software-defined radio and I forget the name of India-based software-defined radio, Apache Labs. And they'll go into it for hours upon hours upon hours. Other people kind of do religious things. Other people do other things. So, other people just play tag. They say hello. They mention the weather. They mention their setup and the signal strength. And then they wish you well, and they move on to the next person. And it's all good.
QSL. But, you know, sometimes I talk to these big, stations with antenna farms, big amplifiers. You know, they give me a 5-9 signal report, and I tell them I'm running 100 watts on the dipole, and that changes everything for them. I don't understand.
In what way does it change everything from them?
Well, you know, somehow I have a good signal wherever they are, and I'm not doing so much of the work, you know. Maybe they're involved in some kind of commerce, you know.
I'm not quite sure about that. You know, I mean, one of the benefits of talking to a big gun station is you basically have reciprocity with them. They're kind of doing somewhat the heavy lifting, but, you know, if the point of the conversation is having a conversation, then, you know, whether they're throwing out more watts to you and they have a higher gain antenna to draw in your signal, I think, should be somewhat immaterial. I think the point is the conversation, unless they're looking for something else.
QSL, QSL, QSL. Well, I usually talk to stations that are very loud signals because it's easy to have a conversation with them. It's facilitating, you know, the conversation. And I don't really contact too many low-powered stations because I don't think I really hear them.
Well, I mean, that's very common in the metropolitan area. It's very difficult to be able to put up the greatest of antenna systems. There's a lot of background electromagnetic interference that goes on. Most people like you tend to hear and understand and respond to the strongest signals that they can receive. There are guys out there who are very much into QRP, which is basically 5 watts or less, and they hunt around and they seek out the low signals. And, you know, they sort of revel in their ability to communicate over wide areas with a negligible amount of power. But again, you know, it's what you're looking for.
QSL, QSL. And there are some people that they operate QRP with multi-element antennas and towers that are at least 50 feet high.
Yeah, there certainly are. I don't think that quite meets the spirit of QRP, although, you know, as I mentioned before, it is primarily just based on transmitter power. But you're going to have a heck of a lot better chances with 5 watts if you put it up, you know, 100, 150 feet up with a multi-beam array and have a high gain. But, you know, if people have the money, they spend it. Those things can get rather expensive. Real estate isn't that much of a problem in some portions of the country, but it still costs a great deal of money to have those towers put together and maintained.
QSL. Some people, one person I heard was talking about putting 200 milliwatts into a mega antenna.
Okay, you could do that. Again, if you put it into a really big system, you might get something. In addition to QRP operators, there's the guys who call themselves QQRP, meaning that I think that term is reserved for people who, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's below 1 watt of output. So, yeah, if you get a big enough, you know, if you get something out of NASA, the Jet Propulsion Lab, you can do wonders with under a watt. But, again, that's quite in the spirit of things.
My mentor, best friend, ham radio friend, had a home-brewed kilowatt on 440 for CW signal to an antenna-foot tower, 40 feet high, 40 feet wide, and 16, 32-element antennas, all homebrewed. So it's stock of 4 over 4. And he sent the signal to the moon and back, you know. Said it was quite amazing, you know, what some people do with this technology.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're talking about Moon Bounce, Barry, N2MB. Was very much into Moon Bounce. There's kind of two groups of Moon Bounce as far as I've perceived. The old timers use the older technology. They threw a lot of power, as your friend did, maximum, you know, 1.5 kilowatts. You get an array of directional high gain Yagis. There's a wonderful picture of Dick, K2RIW. He had a QSL card with him standing on his tower with an incredible array of Yagis. That was the way that you did it. You just threw a lot of electronics and you bounced off the moon. nowadays, with the onset of very, very lower power, slow digital technology, the JT, Taylor's, Joe Taylor's technology, you don't quite need that much power. Some guys with a much less significant shack can use Joe Taylor's technology and accomplish moon bounce using his technology for very, very, very low signal strength, noise correction, digital transmissions to the moon.
QSL. And, you know, I saw him in action in his shack, sending CW and receiving CW, but the CW that he was receiving, it was unstable, you know, could have went up and down in frequency. And,
Did he explain what that was, or was it some artifact of the signal returning, bouncing off the moon?
It was part of the physical process of the communication. So, you know, for some specific scientific phenomena.
Okay. It's a shame that Barry's probably in North Carolina, although sometimes he listens through Echolink. I've never really had a nice long conversation with someone who did it to know the nitty-gritty details of it. It's just they kind of mention that they did it and how they did it, but leave out the details. So that's interesting. I'll have to read up on that and see if there's some kind of Doppler effect or interaction with the ionosphere that causes that.
QSL. Yeah, well, he was pretty busy with that. He spent most of his time doing it. My teacher was his friend. He did satellite communication, also CW, a kilowatt homebrewed on 2 meters, up to the satellite, back down on 10 meters.
Okay, that's interesting. I assume he was using AMSAT satellites at the time. Satellite transmissions have become surprisingly common. There's a lot of guys out there who have tried it and use it. Matter of fact, a lot of times the ICOM 9700 is sort of promoted as a go-to station radio for people interested in satellite, and also there's the ISS repeater that people are trying, although the power requirements have shrunk over time, so that there are some people out there who will do satellites with handy talkies, and in one hand is the radio, the other hand is the antenna, and they're moving things around, and I think they require three arms in order to coordinate all that somehow, but they do it. There's a wealthy guy with azimuth control devices and computer programs, and then there's other guys who just kind of run around and point things at the sky, and they both receive signals. So it's a great time for satellite hobbyists.
Roy, isn't there a repeater for satellites now?
Yeah, I believe there is one of the satellites operates as more than one operates as a repeater. The problem though is with all these things is that they're not geosynchronous. So you send off a signal and it gets echoed sometimes out of your area. So you can't really have much of a conversation as far as I'm aware, just because of the speeds of the non-geosynchronous satellites that are up there being used.
QSL, I don't know so much about these things, except what I saw years ago. So maybe I'll try. If there's a way to listen in, just to listen in. That might be enough for my interest.
Okay, there's a lot of material on websites. You could just Google AMSAT for the amateur radio satellite. You can Google the ISS repeater for information about that. There's a lot of websites that will tell you when it's overhead and the general direction to point antennas at. And, you know, you never know. Maybe just with something as simple as a good handy talkie and a directional handheld Yagi antenna, you could probably pick up all kinds of interesting satellite signals.
Well, I tell you, I was actually very surprised what I could pick up on my roof with an HT.
Well, you know, as we, by the way, AC2GS, by the way, as we mentioned repeatedly, especially when it comes to UHF and VH, where it's mostly line of sight, height is a great feature. You can communicate much farther the higher up you are. And that's one of the reasons why when airplanes are transmitting UHF, VHF, it's not that hard to get a signal back and forth to them. And when you go up to a high building, it makes a much, much greater difference than if you're trying to use your handy talkie on the ground. So as the old saying goes, the three most important aspects to UHF and VHF propagation is height, and height.
QSL, and just getting back to the first part of our conversation, I've been trying setting up different kinds of audio speakers for my radio. Radio that has a front-firing speaker is no audio problem at all. Dual bander is an internal speaker in the back, so it requires something in the front, and I put a speaker there, and it helps a lot, but I'm not sure, you know, maybe I can do better.
Well, I mean, you might try and rearrange what's on the back of your radio. Make sure that there's very little that will absorb the audio and kind of give you a good bounce back. So you want an actually reflective surface as opposed to a sound-absorbing surface. Unless, of course, you get a different sound transducer for the first. For the front, then you're really not interested in reflections from the rear. Sometimes they could muddy the signal that you're getting from a auxiliary front speaker.
QSL, and I think for what I've learned, in any case, if I'm using any external speaker, front-firing speaker is pointed straight at me, straight to my ears. The external speaker is also pointed straight to my ears. So, you know, I find that I get much better clarity, you know, because of that.
Well, yeah, I would agree because it's a point emitter. You know, it's emitting from a source of a limited dimensions, and so it's spreading out its sonic field directly at you, whereas using reflective technology, it's highly dependent upon what it's reflecting at, what the material is, what the angle of incidence is, so there's a lot of complications, and you can rather easily muddle your audio just having the wrong type of reflections go on. I was never a big fan of Bose speakers back in the old days. They used a lot of reflective technology in increasing the apparent size of the speaker system. I had a set, and I was never really a big fan. I too prefer direct emitters rather than reflective ones.
I remember the Bose speakers. They had speaker elements in the back. You had to keep it a foot or a foot and a half away from the wall, But the way it's set up now, this dual-band radio and the speakers, I think you sound perfectly fine. You've got a very good audio signal. Some people, you know, their transmitting signal and their audio signal and or could be problemsome.
Let's move on. Okay, well, we've heard from the audience. David, I want to thank you for your participation tonight. I hope we discussed the subject reasonably well.
You did a fantastic job. Thank you very much. KG2RY, good evening.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, David. Ed, K2GJE, I was wondering if we could table your comment or question for right now so that I could introduce Andy for Andy's Corner, and then we'll get back to you when he's done. Is that okay, Ed?
I probably won't be here after 9. I have a very short question.
Okay, give me the question, Ed.
K2GJE, Ed, what is the impedance at the base of a 5/8 whip? Over.
What is the base, what is the impedance at the base of a 5/8 whip? Now, you're saying, when you say the base, I assume you mean after the loading coil, because before the loading coil, it's certainly not going to be anything close to matching the coax cable or the transmitter. So you're saying after the loading coil, right?
No, without the loading coil. I know if I go out and buy a commercial 5/8 whip, in the base they have a loading coil. If I want to build my own and build my own matching network, what is the impedance of a 5/8? Over.
Okay, I don't know exactly. I know it is primarily a capacitive reactant because it's necessary to neutralize the capacitive reactants with an inductor. I don't recall the exact number, though. I get the idea that you do.
Someone listening might have an answer, over.
Okay, very well, Ed. If anyone out there knows the nominal impedance of an uncorrected 5/8 wave antenna, please raise your hand.
Alpha Bravo 6, Mike Bravo.
Yes, good to hear from you, Jeff. Jeff, AB6MB, is the net control operator for the Papa Network TechNet. It's on every Friday night, 11 o'clock local, and you can hear him through all kinds of different Echolink and the hotspots that connect to the Papa Network. So, Jeff, you were talking about 5/8 wave a few weeks ago on your own antenna net. If you'd like to educate us about the nominal impedance of an uncorrected 5/8 wave, I'd love it.
Yeah, there, Roy, I was actually having to search for that exact impedance, by the way. It's 75 ohms with capacitive reactants on top of it. Back to you.
Okay, so do you know offhand how much of it is real resistive and how much of it is capacitive?
Ohms is the real resistance or radiation resistance, and then the capacitive is just reactive.
WB2EAB, I believe it's minus J246 ohms reactive.
Okay, thank you very much, Ed. So, Ed EAV tells us that the capacitive reactance is 240.
That sounds right to me. I didn't remember the number, Roy, but I remember the ohm, so.
Okay, so Ed's K2GJE, apparently from the sources, although it probably is easy enough to Google, it's 75 ohms of real resistance and 240 ohms of capacitive reactance. Did you get that, Ed?
K2GJE, yes I did, I wrote it down. That would, the capacitive reactance of 240 would be very easily corrected with an inductor of 240, which would probably phase it out, and then it would look like a pure 75 ohms over.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful? I love it.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically tuning it to operate sort of like a electronic version of a three-quarters wave, vertical.
A three-quarter wave is a half and a quarter, so the half repeats itself, and then you're looking at what a quarter looks like, which is a low impedance. And that's one way of transforming it so you can easily feed it. Okay, I have a question, but you probably don't have time.
WI2U.
Yes, WI2U.
Yeah, okay, this is Mike, WI2U, and I did an easy neck prediction of what a 5/8 wave antenna would be. Mounted about 10 feet off the ground on 20 meters using quarter wave radials without a matching circuit, and EasyNeck predicts 68 minus J174. So somebody said 75 minus J240. That would get you pretty close. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike. So we have two numbers that are relatively close. Fascinating subject of 5/8. I have one for my 10-meter use, but it's not uncommon in UHF, VHF.
Yeah, EasyNeck's a very accurate modeling program. If you put in the right number of pulses and make sure that the final model converges, and again, this model that I did here assumes a 5/8 wave radiator. I use the 3/4 inch diameter copper pipe just for convenience, with four resonant radials mounted about 12 feet off the ground. And again, without a matching circuit, it's 68 minus J175, thereabouts. So whoever said 75 minus J, 200, that should be a good starting point. WI2U.
Okay, very good, Mike. Thank you very much for your help. I hope this helps you, Ed. I think I need to go over to Andy because he's going to work tomorrow, but please come back next week with answers or topics or comments or what have you. We enjoy having you and participate in this technical mess.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Ed. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limewalk Technical Net. It's here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. So it is now time for Andy, WA2CDL, with Andy's Corner. Andy.
Okay, let's see if this works. Yeah, my radio is working. good evening, everyone. WA2CDL here in East Corner with another edition episode of Andy's Corner. It's almost 9 o'clock. Yes, I do have to go to work tomorrow, so I can't stay that long. I've been trading. I'm the trainer in this case. Some people from New York City Transit and regarding their communication system, which I've been involved with for the past, how many years? I forget. So, anyway, I gotta go and do this training. Okay, so to bring everybody up to date where we are right now, as Roy mentioned, I'm going to be actually talking about this impedance matching article with using transmission lines, and this is directly out of QST, November 2019. And it was by Ward Silver, N0AX, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard the name. So I want to make sure I don't time it out, because I usually do, so let me let it drop. Okay, thanks for that. So the past number of weeks, months, years, it seems that way, I've been talking about transmission lines to give an overview of what a transmission line is, what it does, how it's used, where it's used, and so on. And even to my own edification, because I forget myself. if you don't work with this stuff, you don't retain it, especially when you get older. So, mainly, this article in QST uses coax cables, coaxial lines to match impedances. And just as an overview, we spoke about in the past number of weeks the different types of transmission lines, because you have different types. You got your two-wire, four-wire, solid dielectric, coax, of course, waveguide, service waveguide, and so on. And what I spoke about, and this is just to recap what we spoke about, the characteristics of transmission lines, what they look like electrically, how the wave propagates along the transmission line, the current voltage relationships, the surge and load impedances of the line itself, and there's a formula. It's actually the square root of the inductance divided by the capacitance of the line, which is the impedance of the line, and so on. And then I spoke about lines with unmatched loads, and how an unmatched load will form a standing wave, and how standing waves are used in certain instances to match or unmatch impedances, so they could be used to an advantage and also a disadvantage. So I spoke about that, and how standing waves are formed, the formation of it. There's a lot of pictorials with this, and that's the problem. Maybe we should go to a Zoom meeting, a Zoom TechNet, where I could actually show on a piece of paper what's going on, maybe in the future. So with these pictorials show the different standing waves, and then we get into standing wave ratio, which is VSWR, a voltage max, voltage min, and then we spoke a little bit about a reflectometer, which measures the standing wave ratio. And then we got into transmission lines as circuit elements. And that's the most interesting topic, because...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, W-H-C-D-L. See, I didn't have anybody remind me. transmission lines are circuit elements. So when I spoke about what lines look like when you send a signal on a line that's opened or shorted at different wavelength lines, quarter waves, or less than quarter waves, quarter waves, greater than quarter waves, less than half waves, or exactly half waves. Because every half wave, the impedances are repeated. And every quarter wave, it's inverted. It's just the opposite. And that's along the line. And so I mentioned about lines being open and also lines being shorted, and the equivalent circuit that it creates, either being capacitive, inductive, series resonant, or parallel resonant. And by Ohm's law, if people remember their impedance formulas, you know, or what a parallel resonance circuit looks like at, when it's at resonance, or when a series resonance circuit looks like when it's at resonance. Because of you know, the properties of it, you have obviously series resonance circuit at resonance, impedance is low because your capacitive and inductive reactances cancel out. In a parallel resonance circuit, the impedance is high. So the transmission lines, the coax cables, can duplicate those circuits, and it becomes an equivalent circuit to what I just described. So that could be used again for matching impedances, which is what this article is about. And then the last thing I spoke about was the losses on the line, because every transmission line has losses. It's usually measured in decibels, and for a certain number of feet, 100 feet, 200 feet, 1,000 feet, whatever it is. And then we spoke about that. And then the last thing I spoke about was line efficiency. And it's the attenuation, the overall losses of a match line, and it's attenuation that that occurs. So how efficient is the line? So with all that stuff that I mentioned, let me let it drop again. And I hope somebody got something out of this, because I got to keep reviewing, because my memory is so bad, I keep forgetting. You know, again, if you don't work with something every day, or at least for me, I forget it. So I got to start learning all over again. So if I forget something and leave something out or don't remember, please forgive me. I'm at that age now. I'm getting there. So with everything that we discussed up to this point, these past number of weeks, was leading up to the article, which I'm going to just read to you. And let's see how much of this article I understand, as well as the general audience out there, if anybody's really interested in this kind of stuff. So before I go on, I just want to make sure anyone in the listening audience have any questions regarding to this material that I've covered up to this point.
Linemark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
Okay, I got the Linemark TechNet at 8 o'clock. Thank you for that announcement. All right, so I guess there's no question. So any question, I would have to go back anyway and just try to scratch my head and try to figure out how to answer the question. So that's the hardest part. So as per QST, in the previous article about impedance matching circuits, we discussed what impedance is and learned that what we call impedance matching is really impedance converting. We reviewed several circuits and components that perform impedance conversion. All right, so that was a previous article from him, from Ward Silver. This article covers other methods of converting impedances using the properties of transmission lines, special lengths, combinations, and connections of feed lines can be used. At antenna feed points, the same ideas can be used to create structures that convert impedances too. That means, you know, convert impedances also. So we're going to mention about that, and that's at the antenna itself, the different ways of matching your coax cable to your antenna. So he'll get into that a little bit. So here we go, feed lines and impedance. Let me let it drop. Okay, by the way, I'm not going to do the whole article because it gets a little bit involved, and I'm not going to have enough time with getting ready for work. But I'm going to I'll get up to the point of antenna feed point matching. So I'll talk about that. Up to antenna feed point matching. Okay, I just thought I'd say that. Feed lines and impedance. We start with a feed line characteristic impedance, abbreviated ZO. This tells us what voltage and current are created by power flowing in a feed line. Just like a circuit, ZO, that's the